Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. 50 years ago today, on March 16, 1968, between 347 and 504 Vietnamese civilians were killed by U.S. troops at the village of My Lai. The world wouldn't learn about My Lai until later in 1969, but the images of women, children, and older men who were gunned down was a turning point in the war in Vietnam. Only one U.S. soldier, Lieutenant William Calley, was convicted of any crimes, and Calley's defense was that he was just following orders from his superiors. Calley spent 3 years on house arrest. On the first half of today's program, we'll talk about My Lai and the lessons learned from the massacre. Joining us is Dr. Conrad Crane, Chief of Historical Services for the Army Heritage and Education Center at the Carlisle Barracks. Dr. Crane, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much. Always glad to be here.
And also joining us is Lieutenant Colonel Gary Law, a student at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle, also served in Iraq and Afghanistan. Colonel Law, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here as well.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532, or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Let's go back to March 16th, 1968. It's referred to as the My Lai Massacre, although it actually occurred in several villages. Company C, 1st Battalion, 20th Infantry Regiment, 11th Brigade, 23rd Americali Infantry Division was ordered on a search-and-destroy mission. Colonel Crane, what happened?
Well, their intel was that they were going to run into a VC main force unit, and there was not supposed to be any civilians there. And basically, the company went in, and they started encountering civilians, and they basically executed mass murder. They lined up people. They gunned them down. There were examples of rapes as well. There was very little attempt to restrain the troops, except for one helicopter pilot, Hugh Thompson, who came in with his crew and actually forcibly interposed between some of the killers and some of the people they were shooting. It was a double blot on the Army. It not only was the massacre itself a blot and the cover-up that followed, but the Army also did a terrible job with justice about what happened. Their 25 people were indicted for either war crimes or the cover-up, and only one was ever convicted, Lieutenant Calley, and even his life sentence was ended up just a few years in house arrest, and eventually he spent 6 months in prison and then was on paroled. So it was a double blot. I actually entered West Point in 1970, and West Point was in great turmoil about My Lai. The superintendent, Samuel Coster, was actually commander of the division, the commander of the Americal division. He'd been relieved as superintendent at West Point because of the backlash. He and Cali are really the only people who really suffer from any kind of retribution for what they did. His son was my squad leader, Samuel Coster Jr., and I remember one night in the mess hall that this figure sneaks in through the kitchen in order to have dinner at our table, and it was the former superintendent of West Point sneaking in to have dinner with his son. He was in great disgrace. We watched in our law course at West Point, we had to listen to General Pierce talk about, he was in charge of the Army's investigation afterward, and we had to listen to General Pierce talk about the 25 people that had indicted and how the Army just couldn't. Four of them were acquitted by court-martials, because their peers in Vietnam gave them the benefit of the doubt. Calley's the only one actually was convicted, and the other people just got off. It was really, we were ashamed. We were all kind of ashamed at that point of the Army that we were entering.
To just kind of go backwards, a little bit of background here, as you mentioned, you said VC, Viet Cong guerrillas, that there were reports in intelligence that there were reports of Viet Cong guerrillas in the My Lai area.
It was a local force battalion, supposedly.
And for those who may not be familiar with how this happened 50 years ago, I mean, it was not uncommon for the local population to hide and to be sympathetic to the guerrillas, correct?
No, that's correct. But there are some other factors here as well. Besides the bad intelligence, the Americal Division was a disaster waiting to happen. At that point in its history, it had become a dumping ground for all the problem children in the Army. The Army's NCO Corps was devastated. So was the Junior Officer Corps. Most of the NCOs and lieutenants had like 3 months of training, and then they were sent into combat. Lieutenant Callie, who was the the platoon leader who was convicted. He said that the only orientation he had in Vietnam on his trip over was a briefing that told him not to rape the women. And Callie's previous experience, he'd been a company clerk. He'd been a good company clerk in the States. They thought he was officer material. They sent him to OCS for 3 months. And then all of a sudden, he finds himself in Vietnam in combat.
And Callie's defense was that he was just following orders. Many people throughout history would point out that that's what the defense was for a lot of the Nazis who were convicted of war crimes as well. So what were the orders, and how did it go so wrong that between 347 and 504 dead, there's still no agreement on exactly the amount of people who were killed? How did it go so wrong?
It was bad leadership. They didn't expect civilians. They had not been given any instructions how to deal with civilians, though they should have known. Part of what the sympathy Callie got was the fact that the Colonel Henderson, the battalion brigade commander, the brigade commander had gotten off. He'd been acquitted by a court-martial. None of the superior officers had been thrown in jail. So it was easy to say, well, how can you let all these other people off, and I'm just a lieutenant, why blame me? There's no record there were any orders given to shoot civilians. It violated all the standard operating procedures for the division, for the Army in Vietnam. My battalion commander gave me the order. Well, there was no proof the battalion commander gave, or the company commander, Captain Medina, whose name gets thrown around a lot.
Ernest Medina, yes.
But he was not, he was never court-martialed. He denied that he gave orders to shoot civilians. And I'm sure Colonel Law will talk about it, they're taught pretty well about what is a legal order and what is not a legal order. This is just a failure of leadership and just a lot of bad people doing bad things.
And we will get into the lessons learned from My Lai, but getting back to the incident itself, this company was on a search and destroy mission.
Correct.
What does that mean?
Search and destroy is you enter enemy territory, you're looking for guerrillas, you're looking for enemy forces, you're looking for weapons caches. The idea is to disrupt and destroy enemy forces. And again, you go into a village, you expect that there'll be stored arms caches in the village you may have to dig out. A lot of times you would go in and detain all the males in a village in order to interrogate them later, investigate them later. But this is a case in Song Mai and My Lai where there was just mostly old people and women and children. And anybody who's seen the pictures, anybody who's seen the pictures in Life magazine realizes this was not any kind of VC main force unit.
Well, I guess that's the question that many people had over the past half century, is that once this company arrived and saw that there were no men of fighting age, or very few men of fighting age, there was just women, children, and older men, that they should have realized that the intel was bad and called it in and said, listen, there's no VC here.
And it's a bad unit with bad leadership. They had suffered some casualties. And again, I'm sure Colonel Law will talk about some of the impacts on that can make on a unit and how you have to deal with it. When I was the lead author for the counterinsurgency doctrine for General Petraeus, who went into Iraq in 2007. We actually put a whole chapter in that doctrine about leadership and ethical challenges in this kind of war. War amongst the people is tough. It's not like two major armies on a battlefield where you know the guys in the other uniform are the bad guys, and all the guys in our uniform are the friends. This is a much more complex situation. It takes a very subtle leadership. You got a lot of different pressures on you. And this unit it's a failure of leadership. It's a failure of individual activity. It's a failure of the Army to report it properly. It's a failure of the Army to prosecute properly the people with the war crimes. It's a real blot, and it's never going to go away. I've been to Vietnam. I visited Song Mai, which is now very Disneyfied. American money built a hospital there. It built a museum there. You go through the village, they've got little plaques where each of the huts were, and they list who was killed there. And if you give them 24 hours notice, they'll bring you a survivor to talk to. So, that's a blot that's going to be there forever.
What about the cover-up? the world didn't learn about the massacre at My Lai until about November of 1969, about 18 months later. Seymour Hersh wrote about it, and then there were photographs that were here in the United States. And many point to My Lai as being a turning point. Let's talk about those two different things. What was the Army thinking with the cover-up?
Well, actually, the first indicator is there's a soldier named Ron Ridenour who I've actually heard him speak, who some of his friends started talking about what they had done at My Lai. And he wrote a letter to the chair of the House Armed Services Committee about that. And the House Armed Services Committee initiates an investigation. The Army hears about it, initiates an investigation, too. And the investigation is actually going on. The Army's kind of keeping it kind of low key. They're starting to find out how big the cover-up was and how again, General Koster and the command chain had covered it up. And then the Hersh. So there was already an investigation going on when the Hersh book breaks, which really puts it out in the public. And then the Life magazine photos show up, which really explodes the whole case. And then that also brings to light the Army's failure to be able to prosecute people and makes it even worse. But the Army was actually investigating it before the Hersh book comes out, but that obviously cranks up the pressure and the publicity considerably.
Historians do point to My Lai as a turning point. It was at that point in 1968, 1969. I mean, a lot of people talk about Walter Cronkite on CBS Evening News saying that the war cannot be won. He had been in Vietnam during the Tet Offensive. And people back home are starting to get a little bit tired of it. But when they see those photographs of women, dead children in a ditch, for the most part, the most famous photographs. It's like, okay, what are we doing here? This is not the kind of war that the United States faces. I don't know whether you as a historian, but whether the Army looked at that aspect of it or not, but do you see it as a turning point in the war?
Well, it's a turning point for the Army in a lot of ways. I mean, again, I'm at West Point at the time, and we were ashamed of ourselves. I mean, that just made it, what kind of profession am I getting into here? It leads General Westmoreland to do a complete study of professionalism in the Army, which is going to cause a whole lot of leadership changes in the 1970s for an Army that was a very bad Army. I mean, it was very, the Army at the end of Vietnam into the 1970s was really a shambles, a shell of what it is now. Bad leadership, bad soldiers. It really led the Army. Not only was the public questioning the role in Vietnam, but the Army started to question itself. You know, have we lost our moral compass? How could this happen? How could this happen? This organization? How could this kind of mass murder happen? With all the training we try to do and this it just really made the Army question itself. And so it's the public is questioning the Army. The Army is questioning itself. The support for Vietnam is falling. It was a real crisis at a lot of different levels.
But when you say bad soldiers, I mean, we know that so many Vietnam vets came home and were afraid to even talk about their service. They were told not to wear their uniforms in public airports. They were called baby killers. That we heard stories that they were spit on, that kind of thing. Recently, though, and I say recently, maybe in the last 20 years, we have a new respect for the Vietnam veteran. So when you're saying bad soldiers, I mean, those soldiers, a lot of them were drafted into the military, but it sounds like they didn't get a lot of training, good training, and didn't get a lot of good leadership.
Again, the Maracal Division at that time was all the bad things that could happen to unit had happened to them. A book I recommend to everybody to read is a book called Stolen Valor by W.B. Burkett, which really gets at the myth of this bad Vietnam veteran and shows how the vast majority of Vietnam veterans did well. They became outstanding citizens. A lot of the press about bad Vietnam veterans is from people that aren't even veterans. They're false veterans. It's a terrific book, Stolen Valor. And again, it's that's part of the problem with the So My My Lai is that it becomes a brand for 98% of Vietnam veterans that did fine. And it's just this one unit, this one time with this massive leadership failure, which is a blot on the Army forever.
We're going to talk about the lessons learned from My Lai in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're talking about 50 years ago today, March 16th, 1968, the My Lai Massacre in Vietnam. where almost 500, maybe up to 500 civilians were killed by one company in the U.S. Army. Our guest, Dr. Conrad Crane, Chief of Historical Services for the Army Heritage and Education Center at Carlisle Barracks, and Lieutenant Colonel Gary Law, a student at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle, who also served in Iraq and Afghanistan. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Colonel Gary Law, I want to turn to you now. You served in leadership positions in both Iraq and Afghanistan, and you're a student at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle. Were there lessons? Is My Lai taught today? What went wrong at My Lai in today's Army?
So yes, of course. So obviously, I spent a lot of time in Iraq and Afghanistan, and also training units as well. I spent time at the National Training Center and then within 1st Army training units to deploy to Iraq and Afghanistan into any theater of operations. So yes, there were a lot of lessons learned. And I would say in Vietnam, and our Vietnam veterans out there did a tremendous job of what they had to do. And I have a profound respect for their commitment, for their honor, and their sacrifice. You know, when they came back, a lot of lessons were identified. You know, the soldiers, commanders, and leaders said, hey, we need to fix a lot of things to make it better. And through that was through education, training, and then everybody knows we went to an all-volunteer force. So with that, let me tell you about our soldiers. You know, they're volunteers, they're motivated, they're trained, and they're educated. And the biggest thing is I'll go into the training here. So in training, we actually talk about a complex battlefield environment that our soldiers are put through, that they deal with conventional threat, they deal with insurgents, they deal with criminal elements. They work with civilians on the battlefield, they work with media, and they have all these elements on the battlefield that they have to work through, you know, this tactical problem they have to get through to do the right thing they need to do. The next thing is education. Our soldiers go through really a career-long of education in and out of operational assignments that we call professional military education. So, for example, our enlist our soldiers. They go to basic training in AIT. Then they'll go into the operational field. They'll come back, and they'll do what's called, you know, the warrior leader course, about the E4, E5 level. They'll go back to operational unit, and they'll go into senior leader course, an advanced leader course, and a master leader course. And in those, they go into vignettes about what happened at My Lai, and then several other vignettes about other additional issues on previous wars or current wars about what occurred, and going through the ethical dilemmas that were put in, and going through the ethical reasoning about coming with the right decisions of what they need to do. Officers, the same thing as well. Continuous education all the way through their military career as a lieutenant, basic course, captain's career course, Commander General Staff College, and even where I'm at right here, the Army War College. You know, 21 years in the Army, I'm going back to school, and through there we go through those strategic leadership, ethical dilemmas, ethical reasoning about the situations out there. And I'll tell you, when I first showed up as a lieutenant at Fort Bragg, brand new, right out of college, the battalion commander had a reading list, and this was in 1997. And one of those books was on My Lai by Seymour Hersh. We had to read that book and write a report on it and to give it back to our company commander, give it to the battalion commander for them to grade. And I'm thinking, man, I just got out of college. I got to read another book.
What grade did you get?
I know I got a bunch of comments on it about my writing style, about what I learned and things like that. So
what did you learn from that book? What did you learn from My Lai that you've been able to use as a leader?
So even in that book, and even in Iraq and Afghanistan, Dr. Conrad and I talked about, you know, the exercise of disciplined violence is a challenging thing, and the American public puts that trust into the military to do the right thing, and with that is, you know, we have to go through those ethical clouds or ethical dilemmas that we put in there, but it boils down to discipline. Which is the military discipline is doing the right thing. Yes, emotions are out there. Any of my veterans out there know that that your buddies get hurt and injured, and I know that's what happened at My Lai. Several days before, they took several casualties, so I'm sure those emotions were high. But at the same time, you got to understand that the discipline there. You know, hey, you got to understand that and go in here and do the right thing. Because we all know about the strategic corporal level now, that the military calls it. If we go in there and a lieutenant can now make a decision or a private can make a decision today on today's battlefield, and it will have strategic effects with modern-day technology, with everybody has a cell phone, with the communications equipment that's out there, it will have strategic effects across the battlefield. And so we understand that. We also understand, obviously, that, you know, doing those things, having it at My Lai, the ranks of the Viet Cong, you know, were they swelled after My Lai? I would argue probably yes. It makes your life harder. And obviously, you know, following the rules of engagement, doing the right thing, understanding the rules of law and force is profound and taught throughout our training centers, throughout our military education, all the way through a soldier's career.
What are the rules of engagement? I mean, there are probably a lot of them, but the highlights, the major rules of engagement when it comes to interrogating, when it comes to dealing with civilians.
So obviously, it's a you know, every soldier has a right to defend themselves, and every theater, every operation would have a different rules of engagement. Mm-hmm. It's based on the circumstances why they're there. It's based on what their mission is there. It's based on the threat that's there. But obviously, it's, you know, not the murdering or killing of innocent civilians. That's enforcing every rules of engagement. Soldier has a right to defend himself and use force only when force is necessary. In general. You know, and following the, you know, law of war, you know, the rules of engagement, like I said before, all those things that they need to understand and that they do that because, you know, the military wants to be there, you know, do the right thing and complete the mission, help those people that are there, and to, you know, whatever they need to do, they do that. And breaking the rules of engagement will only compound or make that problem worse or harder.
My Lai was one of the lowest points, if not the lowest point, in U.S. Army history. But unfortunately, during Iraq, especially Iraq, there have been some other incidents where civilians have been killed, that maybe even murdered. But Abu Ghraib was a great example where there was a breakdown, and that had a great impact on the war in Iraq. So even with training and lessons that we learn from My Lai or other incidents that are similar, there still are breakdowns. How do you prevent that from happening? And Dr. Crane, you can weigh in on this too.
So unfortunately, incidents like that still occur. But remember, even at Abu Ghraib, you know, that incident was nothing like My Lai. And now, granted, it was a tragedy, and but it was restricted to a small group. You know, the army went in, investigated, held people accountable, and then moved on. And I believe in our senior leaders will do that today. Understand the implications of what those types of actions, what those events can bring.
But how did it happen in the first place? I mean, we were talking mostly about a reserve unit, but still, that had been trained. How does an event like that happen? It's not mm-hmm. events, a series of events with Abu Ghraib.
It's a breakdown in leadership.
Yeah.
I mean, the army investigated it. It prosecuted the soldiers. I was in the Pentagon when Abu Ghraib broke. I remember the discussion of the seven soldiers that just lost us the war because of the impact of that incident, which is, again, that it was bad, but it wasn't like My Lai. It's not a mass murder. But, again, they prosecuted the soldiers. They did some things with leadership. There was action taken very quickly. There was no cover-up. I mean, once it came out, the Army was very, very open what was going on. There have been some cases where soldiers have killed civilians, and the response has been pretty quick. I mean, the Army is doing much better now at responding and trying to, you know, to take dealing with those situations and prosecuting the soldiers who are guilty. Wars, it's a complex business. You know, there's still a bunch of young soldiers out there, and they make mistakes, and you've got to reinforce this kind of training every day. But as Colonel Law mentioned, this is a very complex battlefield we deal with today, and it's a challenge for leaders and soldiers to deal with the very complex problem sets they run into.
There are, and Colonel Law, I'm going to follow up on that. You know, you mentioned, Colonel Crane, that you know, when we're talking about guerrillas, insurgencies, that many times the enemy is not wearing uniforms maybe in Vietnam, there were North Vietnamese actual units that were wearing uniforms. But probably since then, we have not, when we, I'd say we, the United States, has not fought an enemy that was actually, representing a nation or in dressed in uniforms like we picture with World War II or other wars prior to that. So Colonel Law, with that knowledge of not knowing who the enemy is sometimes or being difficult to identify the enemy, when you're talking about a complex battlefield situation, that has to make it even more complex. How do you do that?
Correct. So, you know, this is for my military historians out there. Insurgencies are not new to the U.S. Army.
No.
We have the U.S. Army throughout its history has probably spent just as much time or even more time conducting stability, contingency, counterinsurgency operations. But yes, those battlefields are very challenging as far as, you know, who's the enemy and who's not the enemy. And it's all about, like I said before, it's about, you know, working with the people and understanding, you know, who they are. And we call it empathy, not sympathy, but empathy, understanding who they are, where they're coming from. You know, what help do they need? Why are we there? Why do they need us there? What is their situation? And we gain this empathy for them and understanding, you know, their strengths, their weaknesses, and why we're there. Then it gives us more of understanding of what we need to do to help them. Counterinsurgencies and even, you know, the operations today in Iraq, and it's about the people. It's about training the Afghanistan army, the Iraqi army, to for them to take over and govern their country, govern their borders.
Can you trust the people you're talking to?
You know, we have to, and it's a challenging. And like I said, we go in, you know, we go there, we're working with them, and it's a, you know, just as you trust anybody else next door, it's give and take, and then you see what actions they do or what actions they don't do, and you work to build that trust.
Yeah, but my neighbor next door may not have a grenade or a gun behind them.
That's true, but it's for them too as well. It's them trusting us as well, what our actions, and you know, when something bad happens. So, for example, we have a lot of vignettes at the National Training Center. For example, I talked about is we'll have a platoon leader bring his platoon into, say, a village, and he's supposed to bring humanitarian aid or talk to local elders, and then while he's in that village, IEDs will go off, and he will take, you know, his vehicles be destroyed. He'll have some wounded in action, he'll have some killed in action. And you have to go through those actions. At the same time as he's evacuating his personnel, he may take small arms fire from across a field, and he'll have to deal with that as well. And then he goes through the, basically he's in an ethical dilemma. What do I do? Do I go into the village and take it out on the village elders, or do I work with them, you know, defend myself, evacuate the wounded, evacuate my killed in action, and assess the situation, work with them, find out who they are, and then go after them as well.
We're out of time for this portion of the program. I want to thank both of you for being with us today. Dr. Crane, legacies of My Lai.
Well, again, it's a blot the United States and the Army will never get rid of, but it's also one the Army is basically dedicated itself to never happening again.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us. Dr. Conrad Crane, Chief of Historical Services for the Army Heritage and Education Center at Carlisle Barracks. Lieutenant Colonel Gary Law, a student at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle, served in Afghanistan and Iraq. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Now, we just heard about one of the lowest points in U.S. military history. Now let's transition to a story that can be inspiring. Sadly, almost a million U.S. service personnel have been wounded or injured in Iraq and Afghanistan. Brain injuries and post-traumatic stress disorder have been rampant. But many men and women suffered catastrophic injuries and came home with a loss of a leg or an arm. As a result, their families often became caregivers, where they required care on a constant basis. Next Thursday, March 22nd, the U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center Foundation is showing the documentary film The Weight of Honor that chronicles the caregivers. Joining us to talk about the film, talk about caregiving, is Lieutenant Colonel David Rozell. His autobiography is titled Back in Action. He'll be leading the discussion at the film, or after the film, The Weight of Honor. Colonel Rozell, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure to be here today.
Also joining us is Stephanie Selden Howard, who is the executive director, producer, and writer of the film The Weight of Honor. Ms. Howard, welcome to the show as well.
Thank you very much.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Before we talk about the film, Colonel Bazell, I wanted to talk about your experiences in Afghanistan and Iraq. You were one of the people, one of the service personnel that did suffer a catastrophic injury. You lost a leg. Tell me the story. How did that happen that you suffered this injury?
Sure. Back in 2003, I was commanding a convoy in the town of Heat, Iraq. Back early in the war, right after the invasion, so just been in the country just a couple months, ran over a landmine, took my right foot, basically, had an amputation there, my first one in Baghdad, and came back to Walter Reed. My wife was, Kim, was 7.5 months pregnant at the time, so she was unable to fly back. So the first caregiver experience I had was actually my mother having to travel up from South Carolina to come take care of me. And then when she was there, she found herself thrown into that caregiver role by going and seeing the other men and women that were on Ward 57, the famous Ward 57 at Walter Reed, where she was having to give some motherly care to other people whose families were unable to come. And that was kind of the first eye-opening experience for me of wow, this is going to take a lot of work. This is more than about just guys getting injured, getting them patched back up and getting them back to life. This is going to be a long-term process. And you know, I was very lucky. I had a great support system. I made it home to Colorado. Then there were no centers of excellence for that kind of medical treatment, so went back to Fort Carson, threw my VA paperwork away because I had been promised another command once I got fixed up. Went back, and my wife became a caregiver for me for that next year. And as I was talking to a friend this morning, it's 14 years of recovery for me. So it's been quite a journey, and you know, I'm still finding new ways to make life better. So it's a lifelong trip.
And I imagine that those first few days, those first few months, even those first few years, while you're working on, okay, who will be providing care, there are a lot of thoughts that go through your mind. I want to go all the way back to Baghdad when your foot was amputated. I mean, what goes through your mind? I imagine someone comes in and says, or I don't know, maybe not, says that we're going to have to take a portion of your leg. What goes through your mind?
Well, it was. Yeah, you know, I'm a military leader, so I was thinking of it operationally. So the doctor came in and said, "Hey, I'm going to give you two options." And it was funny because right then, when he said that, a mortar round went off just outside the tent, and dust from the ceiling came down. And I looked and I said, "Are you doing the surgery here? Because this doesn't look like the right place." And he goes, "Oh no, it'll be fine. It'll get washed out when you get home." So you know, real sense of urgency there. But, you know, that decision that he gave me was, you know, for him to try to put something together. I didn't have a heel bone anymore. I had a huge hole in the middle of my foot. And he said, "I can probably put something back together that will look like a foot, but you'll be a cripple the rest of your life. The other option is for me to go ahead and do a amputation, and then you can go from there." I said, "Well, you know, I had no idea what that meant. I really, on the way back, I knew something was serious wrong, you know, but there was that decision I had to make of, okay, how do I want to live the rest of my life? And I had no training or understanding of what that was. And it's something that we've gone back and we've done better now. The Army's much better, and DOD really, much better in explaining medical injury and how to treat it and, you know, teach that resiliency piece. But back then, that was a very tough decision. And ultimately what I said was, if I get an amputation, can I run again? And really, that's what I was thinking operationally is I wanted to serve, and I knew that if I could run, then I could serve. And that's what it boiled down to. And I said, okay, go ahead and take it. Put the drugs in me, put me out, woke up, was an amputee laying in a bed next to a Iraqi prisoner that had been shot. And I was very angry. And I said, what in the world is happening? And, you know, it just turns out they were flooded with injured. And so there I was laying next to a guy that one of my guys had shot in combat. So it was a very different time back in 2003. I can tell you, things have changed.
What kind of communication did you have with your bedmate there?
No, he moved immediately.
I would think, yeah. Eventually, though, as you said, you start thinking about what is the rest of my life going to be. When did you realize that you were going to need care? If maybe not for the rest of your life, but you were going to need a lot of care to recover from that injury.
Well, I don't want to change gears on you in a sense, but it wasn't about me at that point. I think it took me about 2 weeks to get to Landstuhl, Germany, finally. So I went through United Arab Emirates. I sort of got lost in the system. It was the beginning of the war, so it was crazy. But I finally got to Landstuhl, and the nurses were coming to my room and saying, hey, Captain Rizal, we need you to go talk to these soldiers. They're having a really hard time. We need you to go over to the ward where the junior enlisted guys are. I need you to talk to them to motivate them. There's some guys that are really broken. I looked and I said, well, I'm really broken. But you're always a leader, right? I mean, so you don't get a day off when you're in charge. So even though they weren't my men, they were soldiers and sailors and airmen, and there they were. And I, you know, rolled myself in a wheelchair, and I started talking to those guys, and I realized, wow, this role of being a leader is not going to stop now. And so I started to build some armor on how I'd take care of myself by taking care of others. And it's been a very positive way for me to heal these last 14 years, is that, you know, I can never feel sorry for myself, because whenever I do, I can always think of all these men and women that have been so much more severely injured than me. And it really drives me every day, even when I am reminded every morning when I wake up and I put a leg on that I am an amputee. But once I take that first step, I'm ready to go the rest of the day. And there's not a lot of guys that can do that.
But as you said, your mother was your first caregiver.
That's correct. And then
your wife. No one seems to be prepared for that role unless that's what they're training for as how they're going to make their living. How did they grow into that role as caregivers?
Well, you know, part of me says that it was natural. My mother has been taking care of me for a long time, and she was a great role model for me as a kid. She's a school teacher, and she was always there for me growing up, and she actually made a correlation to one time. I'm from Austin, Texas, and a big running city, even back in the 80s, and I remember one time that I was very sick and I was about to quit this run, and my mom ran out to me and said, "We'll finish this together." And it kind of has become this motto for us. And when we came to Walter Reed, and Dad stayed out in the hallway, and Mom came in and she grabbed my hand and we cried together, and she said to me, "Hey, we're going to finish this together." And that has just, that's just ingrained in her. I don't know how she does it. She's always been that way. And then to go home to my wife, who's having a baby, and all the attention was supposed to shift onto her, but like, even when we went in for the birth of our son, when we got in, I'm crutching in as the only amputee on post at the time to Fort Carson, the hospital sort of shut down to see what I needed, and I said, no, it's my wife, she's having the baby. And so here my wife is having this new baby and taking care of this guy who's struggling with pain and what his future is and all the emotional and psychological piece with that. I mean, you know, Kim had to transition from not having a lot of worries, honestly, to taking care of a baby and a grown baby at the same time. And she did a great job. And I don't know, they're not, you know, there wasn't any training for that or anything. It's just these moms and wives, boy, they just, I don't know how they do it. They really turn it on. And some don't.
So, as caregivers, what did your wife have to do?
I think goal setting is number one, and I think that's the piece where, we need to, Mother's Day is coming up, so we all need to stop and make sure we give a special thanks to our mothers in May. But, they really, both my mother and my wife, immediately started to set goals for me. So, like at Walter Reed, the key for me to get discharge from Walter Reed was to climb stairs on crutches, to safely climb stairs on crutches. That was one of the requirements to get out of the hospital. And so my mother said, okay, hey, by Friday, we're going to get this done. And she went to physical therapy with me every day, was tracking my progress, was telling me when I was not working hard enough, and, kept challenging me, hey, Friday's coming, we got to get there. And, there she was, and my mother crying at the bottom of the stairs as I went up and down stairs on crutches successfully. And I remember thinking to myself, wow, if I can climb a set of stairs within a week of my last surgery, I think I'm going to be okay. And then getting home, boy, Kim had to set some real goals for me, like get out of the house, get to the gym, go back to work. I mean, some really specific things. And that's really when I got into the physical training. You fall in love with your physical therapist, because they're the ones that can get you back to strength.
Were you taking the trash out and things like that?
Oh, checking the mail. That was my number one task.
Stephanie Selden Howard is the executive director, producer, executive producer, director, and writer of The Weight of Honor, the film that will be shown next Thursday in Carlisle. Ms. Howard, I want to turn to you now and talk about the caregiving aspect of this that the film will focus on. What made you want to make this film?
Well, it was interesting because I come from a civilian background, and Colonel, it's been, you know, interesting to hear your story, and thank you for what you've done for us and even here stateside since your injury. I think that's, well, I know it's remarkable. What interested me is, as I said, I came from, I'm a civilian, and I met several amputees and members of the military who had been harmed catastrophically in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they came to my community to speak to high school and junior high school students, not about their injuries, even though those injuries were quite visible, but they came to talk to them about being different, which really resonated with those students, especially when you think about being the age of junior high and high school students. And then after that, I was talking to a friend of mine who actually was the person who organized that event, and I said, I know there's a film here, but I don't think I can give a new voice to what the veterans themselves have gone to, and listening here, on this radio station, it just confirmed that. But she said that no one had done a film about the caregivers, the men and women and parents and husbands and children who are caring for their wounded, both physically and emotionally. And that's where the road began. I started working on the film, and it took 5 years to research and meet people and to interview people who were willing for us to come in and to go on camera and to really give us their hearts, to really pour out their emotions, because they really and truly want the civilians to understand what it's like to be among those 5.5 million nationally caregiver families. And when I say 5.5 million, I'm talking about families of all wars, not just Iraq and Afghanistan.
What did you learn throughout the 5 years that the film was being made? What did you learn about caregivers?
That they're amazingly resilient. Just as we were talking, that some of them have been pregnant or new mothers when their loved ones were, when they were injured. We're talking about the really young wives. And I don't know how they did it. I don't know how they do it. It's a struggle every day. Some of them have had more children since then, but as was discussed, to become a new parent, a new mother, and to become the mother and main caregiver of a spouse who's severely injured, I don't know how they do that. And what I've learned is that these are amazingly resilient, brave women who have great courage every single day. And that's what I want people to feel when they see the film, that they have met heroes that they didn't know existed.
You said women, and I'm assuming that most other caregivers are women, like here in Colonel Rozelle's case, his wife and his mother. I went to your website, and I saw a description of the film where you talk about how often we would see the woman, who often was a caregiver, standing stoically behind the wounded warrior. And I, as I read that, I was realizing that, okay, we are talking mostly about women in this case, right?
Yes, exactly. In fact, I tried and tried and tried for a long time to find a spouse who would go and be, who would come and be part of the film. I think what we're finding with women who are veterans, women who are injured, is that they're not as interested, or it's not part of their experience to have someone take care of them. And that became an issue. I was speaking to one husband whose wife is so damaged emotionally. She couldn't stand the thought of him even participating in the film, and even if she wasn't in it. So most, I think that the film really shows what the cross-section is. The cross-section is a great majority of the caregivers are women, and many, many, many of them are also children.
When you say so emotionally damaged, what do you mean by that?
Well, she had severe PTSD, and emotionally...
This is the caregiver?
No, she was quite damaged, the one who didn't want to be on the film.
Okay.
The caregivers themselves will sometimes have what's called a secondary PTSD, where they themselves exhibit symptoms of going through a tremendous amount of stress, but they don't... They often don't acknowledge that. In fact, most of the time, they don't. Because they are under a lot of stress. But they don't really think in terms of, oh, I have a choice.
Mm.
I think that some marriages, of course, will break up. But what's shocking to me is that we have at least two families where the vet himself felt he couldn't be in that relationship anymore. And what changed that relationship so much was that the spouse became someone who was caring for them, like a mother or a nurse. And so that intimate relationship between a husband and a wife was destroyed. And that's something that a lot of people now realize needs to be protected and cared for.
Colonel Rizzo, I don't want to get too personal. If you don't want to answer the question, just say so. But did this put any kind of strain on your marriage?
Oh, yeah, of course. I think everyone goes through it. And to Stephanie's point, I mean, they're... The population of and demographics of the population of the severely injured match those in combat. So, you know, that 10% of women that are serving in combat, that matches our population. So out of about 2,000 amputees, there's that same proportionate number of women. But even of the males that are taking caregivers and now to the female that's injured, it's the same thing. It's very difficult. It's a strain on your marriage. It does require us to go back and sometimes capture that and say, okay, hey, you've been a caretaker for now. They're on their own. Now let's work on your marriage. And I'll admit, I mean, I've had several points in my life where I've had to do that as well, where Kim and I've had to take a look at things and say, okay, where are we right now? You know, and it's you know, marriage is a very long marathon. So you gotta check yourself sometimes.
Michael is in York. Michael, you're on the air.
Oh, thanks, Scott. I just wanted to make an observation that I think over about the last 30 years, our society has become very loose with the term hero. Somebody, a police officer, gets shot in the street by some random person, and we call them a hero. A hero to me is a person, an ordinary person who does an extraordinary thing in extraordinary and unexpected circumstances. And I think that these caregivers are true heroes, and that we shouldn't minimize the criteria for a hero because it tends to minimize the great sacrifice and commitment that these caregivers have shown. And also, you know, the draftees from Vietnam and people who were called to serve without having decided to serve. You know, they just got...
Michael, I'm going to have to wrap it up, but hey, thank you very much for your call. Stephanie, my guess is you would agree with him.
Oh, yes, very much. And that's a lot of these women, a lot of these caregivers don't see themselves as heroes. They see themselves as doing what anyone would do for their loved one. And they say that many, many times that, well, what else would they do? I mean, there's a look at me in the interviews, and they say, well, of course I was going to do this, not because I had to necessarily, but because I took those vows in sickness and in health. And it wasn't just because of those vows. It was because this was someone who they loved, and they knew that that person would do the same thing for them. And remember that the men, as Colonel said, who go to war, don't expect to come back wounded like this. And so there is very little preparation, especially in the past. There was very little preparation.
Hey, Stephanie, I have to interrupt you because we're almost out of time. Stephanie Seldon Howard, executive producer, director, writer of The Weight of Honor, Lieutenant Colonel David Rizzell, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Next Thursday, March 22nd.